listener production.
Shares. Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is the Motley Fool Money Mailbag.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money. This is not only our very special mailbag edition, it's the very, very first. Not only mailbag, but Motley Fool Money podcast for 2022. Happy New Year, Andrew Page.
2022 already. Wow. Happy New Year.
Thank you, mate. I'd like to make comment on how the year started and all that good stuff, but we're pre-recording this, and frankly, given the last couple of years, I'm making no predictions of what's happened in the last day and a half. So let's assume everything's okay, hope that everything's okay, and move forward with optimism. And what do you reckon? Is that good?
Yeah, I'll go with that. What else can you do?
Duck and cover, I'm not sure. Mate, let's get straight into it. We've got heaps of questions. And again, thank you, as I said last week, for all the great questions from our members or our listeners. Sorry. Here's one from Alex. Hey, Scott and Andrew. I'm a relatively new investor who's moving from holding just two ETFs to becoming a capital F foolish investor. I have a strategy to invest X dollars each month and grow my portfolio over time. My question is around, this is a really common one, mate, how to grow my portfolio. Do I put my monthly budget into one stock, split my budget between several stocks each month? Do I reinvest in the existing holdings? Do I use the buy recommendations of each month, or accumulate until a buy that I feel particularly passionate about comes along? Help, he says. Your discussion will be most informative. Well, this will be the most informative part. Thanks from Alex. It's a good question, mate. It's always hard to think about how to, I mean, regardless of whether you're a member of an investing service like ours or a community like yours or just a private investor, trying to work out how frequently to invest and how to think about what to invest in, buy more of what you already own, buy some new stocks. We have different questions along this kind of theme relatively regularly. Some people are listening for a while. We've tackled this question a couple of times before, I think, over the long term, mate, but there are always new listeners coming in, and rather than make them go back to the very first episode to listen, we will try and occasionally cover up some old ground. This is one of those, but I'm interested in whether you have a different perspective. What do you reckon? What do you do if you've got some money, you're putting some money aside every month? How do you think about investing it, mate? How frequently and what stocks?
Well, in Alex's case here, he's got two ETFs as a start. So if you're just going as an ETF, low-cost index fund, I would just say just stick with that. You're already diversified. You know, two is probably enough, one for Australia, one for overseas.
Yeah.
You know, whenever you get a bit of extra cash, put it in, you know. I mean, you don't want to be doing it if you've saved up $50 over the month because the brokerage will eat you alive. But, you know, once you've got a reasonable amount of money there so the brokerage isn't too onerous, then, yeah, just do it. That's it. Job done. It's all over, Red Rover. You don't need to make it any more complicated than that. If you are going with individual stocks, that's a much more difficult decision. You definitely don't want to force, in my view, don't want to force it. And you'll often, a lot of the greats talk about this as well. You'll often go for like what feels like an eternity, which is, I don't have any good ideas. And then when it rains, it pours, you'll be spoilt for choice. So I think you do, like what you do will very much depend on the opportunity set that's in front of you, your conviction that is around that, and all the rest of it. So that's a much more difficult question. So I feel as Alex is getting to that part of it. And when it is with that part of it, I haven't actually bought anything major for a little while now. And I would like to, don't get me wrong. I'm not overly compelled at this point in time. That'll change. And when it does, I'll hopefully react with great gusto, vim and vigor. I also think too that generally speaking, if you're doing this right, the best stock to buy is probably one you already own. I think I'm with Buffett on this idea of diversification. I think beyond a certain point, you know.
I think that was Lynch, dude.
Was it?
I think it was Lynch.
Usually you say Buffett and you're right 9 times out of 10.
That's right.
Diversification. Oh, there you go.
I'm Googling it right now. Diversification investor.
Okay.
Here we go.
Well, while you're searching, this idea, you get to a point where, you know, I know actually more than a few people, they've got like 50 stocks in their portfolio. One, it's a huge amount of work. Two, if you get all the benefits of diversification after about 20, 25, really, there's different studies that sort of show different things, but really that's where it starts to max out. Why do you want to buy the market's 26th best stock? Like, it just seems really silly to me. So, and if the best stock to buy isn't one that you already hold, you've got to ask, why am I holding that stock for? Yep. You know, so there's that angle to
it as well. I think that's a really important, that's the same coin, yeah.
You're just kind of like, oh, no, this is a much better one. You know, you can press a couple of buttons and sell that and reinvest it over there, right? Like, you know, I know often there's some tax considerations around that, but you really want to make sure that whatever players you're fielding are the best ones and that you leave the less capable ones on the bench. So that's how I tend to think about it. You just have to see what is available out there, and when opportunity strikes, swing hard, and know that after you swing, it probably won't go well for you in the immediate aftermath because it's just volatility in that. But you'll generally do pretty well over time if that's the approach you take.
So I love that you answered that way. I thought you might, because I'm going to take exactly the opposite view.
Mm-hmm.
We're pre-recording this episode. We're recording it in December, and I bought shares of three companies this morning in the US. And I won't tell you what they are because I'm not allowed to. I probably could actually under our trading rules because it's far enough away that I will have well and truly, those trades will have cleared. We're blocked 2 days either side from talking about our trades publicly, but because it's being pre-recorded, I can probably tell you. It was Amazon. I bought some more Berkshire Hathaway, believe it or not. You'll like that. And I bought some, what else did I buy? Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, and PayPal. And mate, that was because I had some money in my US account. I hadn't invested it. And I went, you know what? I'm sick of sitting on cash. I'm going to find my best three ideas and invest in them. And there were three companies I already owned, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and when I say it's different to your answer, that's kind of the same as your answer, except that I wasn't buying those three because I thought, man, they're so cheap. I've got to go and use some of that cash and go and invest it. I was actually doing the reverse. Like, I hate sitting on cash. I know you're the opposite, which is great. It was, by the way, Peter Lynch. I found that while you were chatting.
Okay.
But Buffett's talking about, you know, being caught with his pants up. Throw a Buffett quote in to make sure we do hit our Buffett quota for this episode. Do it early. That way we can relax for the rest of the episode. I'm a caught with your pants up kind of guy. You know, I think the market will go higher. We kind of briefly touched on this last week. But, you know, if the market's going to go higher over time, and I think it will, then earlier is better than later in my mind to be invested. I like those three companies. And I come in, you know what, I don't want to sit on that cash. I'm going to go on, put that money to work. And so that's exactly the opposite of what you suggested in a way. I mean, bought the same socks and I wasn't buying them at terrible prices. I thought they were attractive prices.
Well, I was going to say, by definition, you must feel as though they're at least fair prices,
yeah,
right?
Totally.
Like if you thought price, that they were stupidly overpriced, you wouldn't do it.
No, and that's your point about the best ones you own. The ones that are probably the ones you own, because it was exactly right. I expect these to be long-term market beaters. So, of course, it makes sense if I still think that I add to them, which is the same as your other point. But I'm not a sit around on my cash, wait for the big pitch, ironically, despite the fact I do love Uncle Warren. You're much more Buffett-esque in this sense than I am. Our service, we run a Motley Fool Share Advisor, invests money every month, doesn't actually invest money. It makes recommendations every month for our members to follow. Monthly cadence, regardless of the market, regardless of whatever, we pick the best stock we can find at that point. That's why it's been pretty good. Oh, by the way, officially 10 years old as of a couple of weeks ago.
How'd you go?
We're pretty well. The average stock pick was up about 72% versus the market of up about 44% over 10 years, which I'm pretty happy with that. But
I bet you there's a bunch of dogs in there, though.
Thank you. There are a lot of dogs in
there. I'm not having fun. I think it's always worth pointing out because...
Oh, totally.
I don't mean to distract you from the point you're making.
a lot
of people miss this. There's a 10-year market outperformance in that. And so the natural reaction is, oh, you've picked some really great stocks and,
back-to-back.
You've just told us that actually there was no timing component to that whatsoever.
Yep, correct.
That there was a bunch of dogs within that. I bet that some of the ones that performed really well performed really badly in the immediate aftermath of when
we mentioned corporate travel. We mentioned travel stocks last week. I own corporate travel management shares. They went from, I think the first recommendation was under $3. They went up to 28 and back to 18 during the COVID crash. They fell to $5 before coming back to now being over 20 again. So yeah, it's been a fun ride.
It just happens. It's worth pointing because that is normal. That is normal. Yep. And just too many people forgo a lifetime of incredible compounding opportunities because they think, oh, yeah, the market, I get it. Yep, really cool. I'm going to do it. Buy, 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 buy. A few go bad. Some of them go really bad. the whole thing doesn't go well in the next 6 months. Oh, this is stupid. I'm out. And that it's the worst lesson to possibly learn. So it's worth reiterating that success is underpinned by all of these things that are just really counterintuitive. So I just wanted to make the point.
Can I add to that, mate? This is not an ad for Share Advisor at all because this is past and the future is the future. I'm just going to read up a paragraph of what I wrote to our members and readers. Hopefully some people listening have already read this before. Here we go. Since in the 10 years, this was written on the 3rd of December, I think, from memory, for the 5th, which was our 10th anniversary. We made 121 recommendations. Our biggest ASX winner is Corporate Travel Management, I own shares, which we recommended on August 23, 2012, and which are up an exact 1,000% at the time of writing. I said in brackets, 1,000.818%. 1,000.18% to be exactly 10X. Exact. Mm-hmm. My biggest loser was Essentia, currently at 97.48%, which was recommended on November 26, 2015. Yep, that one hurts. And here's some numbers to your point. We've made 49 ASX recommendations which have lost money. Some have since been sold. Others are still current recommendations and we're hopeful of better returns in future. 72 have made money. Similarly, many are still current recommendations. And here's the thing. Encouragingly, while our worst loser is down that ugly 98%, we've made 33 ASX recommendations that have at least doubled. Many of those have tripled and more. And then I said, overall, the average of our ASX recommendations over that decade is a gain of 73.2%. If we'd invested in the All Ordinaries instead of our recommendations on each recommendation date, the average gain would have been 44.4%. So that's just the full context, mate.
I'm
glad you said the winners and the losers. I just want to share that. So we've made 49 out of 121 stocks are actually in, not even losing to the market. We've actually lost money. Overall, we put a dollar in and we got less than a dollar's worth of each of those, we haven't literally, but metaphorically, of each of those 49 companies. But 33 have at least doubled and many are up. I said, Corporate Travel's at 11X. It's gained 1,000%. Playing up the double, triple, quadruple, all that kind of stuff.
I'm not surprised at all. I mean, just whether it's you guys or any the really successful fund managers.
Yeah, totally.
It's always that story and it's just... People really forego incredible opportunity by having – it's all about expectation. And the expectation is that do well is that you do well right from the get-go.
All the time. Yeah, that's right.
And that you have a really high strike rate. We've got a bit of an experiment in Strawman where people have all these play money portfolios. I can tell you the people coming at the top, they've got a whole bunch of rubbish in their portfolio. But the ones that go well, man, they go really well. And it is normal. So just really important to stress. Back to the question.
Peter Lynch, speaking of Lynch again, said if you're good in this game, you're right 6 times out of 10.
Yeah.
Our that 49 of 121 that we're losing money on is exactly 40.496%.
There you go. That's pretty
close to the 6. Yeah. Like, well, I'm not saying that, but it's pretty Lynchian, right? Like Lynch was right. We didn't expect anything different to that. And again, that's the point, right? Even though we've been wrong, literally wrong, we've lost money 4 times out of 10. We're actually up meaningfully against the market. And think about that compound over time. Hopefully that's a good win. Anyway, enough about
excellent. Well done. Congrats.
Alex, thanks, mate. I mean, you don't want to buy a few each month necessarily. Otherwise, depending on how much you're saving, if you're saving, you know, $500 a month, buying 3 stocks is not very useful. So it does depend on how much you're saving every month. You can, we've said before, if you want to just simply follow the Motley Fool, whichever service or any service really, any whatever recommendation, if you want the average return the service gets, you need to buy the same stocks the service is recommending. Mm-hmm. So if you just want to simply outsource your stock picking, that's how I would do it. If you want to though, Andrew says regularly, you can borrow an idea but not a conviction. If you need that conviction, if you're not going to trust us in the downtimes as well as the uptimes, then yeah, wait and make sure you like the stocks we're recommending. My only caveat there, Ram, is one I use in general, not about our service, just in general, is if you're going to second guess someone, make sure your second guess is at least as good as their second guess or their first guess. Plenty of people have said, oh, well, I bought these 3 stocks and they're all down. I said, well, what about the ones in between? Oh, I didn't like those ones. Well, you picked the ones that I did badly on and I'm sorry about that. I don't feel good about that. I'm not excusing it. But you didn't pick the ones I was right on and I didn't say only buy those ones or you know, just because you liked a sector or a stock or whatever. And then blame me for getting it wrong. Again, I'm not shirking responsibility for that, but it's just a reminder to, you know, if you have a second guess, just recognize you're taking on the risk of actually saying, you know what, so I like those ideas, but these ones I like more. That's completely fine. That's great. Just know whenever you're choosing a subset of someone else's ideas, if you're using your criteria rather than theirs, your returns will vary positively or negatively from their returns. And that can be great or it can be terrible or somewhere in between. But just know that you're doing that. You're taking an extra level of, I wouldn't say to call it risk, but difference? You're taking more difference. Yeah, it's likely to be, risk is the word the academics would use, but you're going to have a variable outcome. And so they'll be better or worse or somewhere in between if you choose any one subset than what they're going to get themselves. And when we're right 4 times out of 10, if you're only picking 2 stocks or 3 stocks or 4 stocks, maybe you get 2 in each bucket. Maybe there's 3 in one bucket, 1 in the other. Maybe you get 1 that we like and 3 that go badly. And in that case, you're going to do worse than us. So just be mindful of, don't, if you're going to second guess, be careful how you second guess. Does that make sense, mate?
Yeah, I've long said that for any kind of newsletter advisories, whatever. There's only two ways to play it. You're either all in the sense that I'm just blow by blow, I'm doing exactly the same thing and guaranteeing myself the average return.
Yes.
Or I'm saying that this is an idea generator. That's all it is. I'm paying whatever it is per year. And that's just going to give me some ideas that I am then going to take and do my own due diligence on and make up my own mind on.
Yes.
And then that's how you do it. And there's no either or. Is right. I mean, I know, in fact, some of the best fund managers I know subscribe to all of the different newsletters. Yeah. They probably hate half the ideas that come out of them.
That's right.
You know? But they that's do right. it because it's a way of – there's so many stocks out there, you know? It's just a way of just basically saying, oh, it puts something on your radar. But it's your decision. It sounds like you're sort of shirking responsibility, but it's like it is all care, no responsibility. I say it all the time. No one cares about your money more than you do.
Yeah.
And it's just really not you're not doing yourself a favor by shifting blame elsewhere. You're pulling that trigger, and it is your decision. And I think it's not to be mean or anything like that, but I think you need to treat it with that level of respect and awareness. Because what's at stake is your life savings, and you know, you need to take it deadly seriously, and I don't apologize for that. And if that's the way that you're going to play it, by all means, that's how I play it, and that's fine.
So, yeah, exactly.
But you can't go around at the next barbecue telling everyone how much of a genius you are when it goes right. And then blaming everyone else when it goes wrong. It just doesn't work. And I'm saying this is sort of a cruel to be kind kind of thing, but it is.
Totally. Yeah, that's right.
Do you know, you've got to do it that way because that that's how it is. So and it's why it's all like no matter who the advisor is, you've got to look at them really skeptically, and you've got to say, okay, Scott likes this. I like Scott. He seems like a good guy. He's got a good 10-year record. Great. But I'm going to look at everything he puts forward with not a cynical lens, but a skeptical lens.
Yeah, yeah.
How could he be wrong? Wow, he's wrong 40% of the time.
Yeah,
so there's a good chance he is wrong. You know, and I'm not having a go at you individually. I'm saying myself.
No, that's absolutely right. Spot on. Yep.
You know, and then
from that at all.
And then once you've made that decision, it's your decision, and that's the way you've got to play it.
Yes. Just remember, if you're saying I'm wrong or Andrew's wrong or someone else is wrong. You know, the chance that you're right about me being wrong and wrong about me being right, you kind of the odds don't necessarily change, right? So you've got to be righter than me, or equally right, or maybe more wrong to pick those four, because I can't pick them. And if you can, then great. By the way, Motley Fool's always hiring, so let us know if you have a really good long term track record. Mm-hmm. But you're just taking that risk, and that's okay too.
Yep.
Mate, let's move on to a question from Ross, which I really liked. It's interesting, not only because it talks about US trading, which is always interesting, but also the kind of mentality of investing. He says, I've got a question for the podcast. Is there a way to trade US stocks after hours in Australia? Do any of the local platforms allow that? During earnings season, I would like the option to respond quickly to buy or sell. I've been burnt 30% on Peloton this week and would have increased other positions after hours if I could. I'm referring to after hours trading in US markets from Australia. I know many US platforms offer the service, but you can't use them when you're based in Australia. I like to add that I see myself as a long-term investor, not a Johnny Day trader, but due to exposure to some extended growth stocks that can fluctuate wildly when earnings are announced, I would like the option to quickly trim or add to a position. Currently being unable to do this puts me at a disadvantage when the markets are moving after hours. Thanks. By the way, I love the pod, and Andrew seems like a good bloke, but we all know you're the real OG. Thank you, Ross. My estimation of you has gone up immeasurably since then. Not only because you realise I'm the OG, but also that Andrew's not bad, but not quite as good. I kid. But very kind. Thank you, Ross. But Andrew is a very good bloke. He's been a mate for many years. We worked together for a while, as long-term listeners will know. And I am very privileged to do this podcast with him. I enjoyed it immensely, by the way. Don't tell the boss. He doesn't listen, so that's okay. But this is fun. This is really good fun. And we get to do it in workouts, which is kind of fun. Mate, let's go to Ross's question, though. You don't own US shares directly. I'm not sure how much knowledge or otherwise you have about the after-hours trading options in Australia.
And don't care.
Cool. Let's move on then.
I'll elaborate. I feel as though there's, and you know,
you're just annoyed at Ross for calling me the OG, aren't you?
No, he's right. he's absolutely right. I think there's a bit of it's a furphy to think that you could, if only you could react a little bit faster, that you would be okay. Things move so rapidly.
Yep.
And that, you know, I don't think your results are going to change at all, even if you can find someone that does this for you. Mm-hmm. And let's say that there is some edge to be had. Well, let's look at that edge and who's going to be exploiting it. Is it going to be you on your laptop at home, or is it going to be the group of PhD mathematicians with a
with a supercomputer?
With a supercomputer. And by the way, there's a lot of these guys out there. Direct feed to the ASX trading, you know, where people actually, some of these high frequency traders position themselves closer to the exchange, because even though the speed of light is the fastest thing possible, and that's what they're dealing with fiber optic cable here. Mm. There's a slight edge to be had. So it's kind of one. I don't think it makes any difference. Two, even if it did, unless you're at that level, you're not going to be competitive anyway. So it just, like, you know, Paladin comes out and says something, 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 and the market just goes boom, right? Yeah. And it's just like, it's a mistake to think that, A, you got that news first,
yes,
and that you reacted fast enough to make any material difference. So I think it's a distraction. Don't worry about it, is my personal view. People will disagree.
Look, I actually completely agree with you, mate, with the one caveat, which is I haven't seen how quickly the after hours market moves, and it's possible maybe that there is some slower to respond group of people who trade after hours rather than the normal people who use their supercomputers only during hours. But to your point, I'd find that remarkably unlikely.
I doubt it.
So, Ross, seriously, while you might know the price might be $100 at the close of trade, it might be $120 by the end of after hours trading. It'll open up tomorrow morning at $120-ish because that's where they finished the day before, unless there's new news. And that $100-$120 change probably happened at the equivalent of 4 o'clock and 30 seconds when after hours trading commenced immediately, right? I hate the lingo, Matt. They're sort of gapping up or gapping down. It doesn't trade between $4 and $4.20 or $4.30. Sorry, what is $100 now? It doesn't trade between $100 and $120. It just traded at $100, then straight at $120. There was no opportunity to buy in advance of the news, nor frankly trim your position if it was going to go from 80, well, 100 to 80. There's very, very, very rarely an opportunity to actually, as you say, mate, beat the market there, because the market's going to recognize it straight away and do what it's going to do anyway. And so the rest of it, you know, would you like, I mean, you know, it's all control, it's all access. If you want it, go for it. Honest answer, by the way, is I don't know, Ross, how to get that access. I use Schwab and I have a feeling they mail out, I'm not sure. But yeah, do you really want it? Is it really going to be meaningfully additional to your returns? As Andrew said, I don't think so.
It's a recursive problem in the sense that whenever there's any opportunity out there, and sometimes they come along and they're identified, the very act of exploiting them renders them impractical. So let's say that it's true, right? Let's say that Ross is right and that by being able to sort of trade outside of market hours, you get a bit of an edge. Well, you know, you're not the first person to observe this, and others will have observed it and will be exploiting it. And that very act of exploiting it will render it impractical. It's turtles all the way down, right? And it just means that these things just never, ever, ever, ever are practically exploitable unless you happen to be one of the very, very first people to identify and exploit it, which statistically speaking is very, very unlikely.
The market goes from uninformed to informed, and if you can get in between those two words, you can make some money. But once it's informed and those trades happen to recognize the new news, then it's there's no arbitrage there.
I would also say too, just look at all of the great long-term investors and all the great returns that are made. It's sort of like, you know, I'll use a different example that you raised the other day. Let's go back to REA Group 10 years ago. And let's say that I'd have to bring up the price because I'm not familiar with it. Let's say that you bought it 10% more expensive than it was at that point in time.
Yep,
you're right. Do you care? Like, does it make a difference? Yeah, but not really. Mm-hmm. And likewise, if it went to zero, does it make a difference? No, not really. Like when you look at the incredible wealth that is created, it is generally the big gains are made over the years and decades. Mm. And the difference in what you pay for it are rounding errors. It's like go back to 2002 and you know, and buy Amazon at twice as what it was worth, 100% more than the market paid.
Yes, exactly.
You're still doing incredibly well.
If you bought it 3 or 6 or 12 or 20 or 100 or 150 or 300 or 500 or 1,000 or 2,000, you still made a fortune.
Now, you mentioned Accenture before, that it's down 97% for you. Imagine if someone at the time was able to buy it at half the price that you paid.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, they're still down 90 something percent.
Exactly.
Like, yeah, do the maths on it. Right. It doesn't make any difference.
Exactly.
People get way, way too obsessed about these small things that just this turn out to be inconsequential in the long term.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
Mate, question from Liz who says, "Hi Scott and Ram, love the pod." Now, Liz, you've thrown about five different emojis in here. I'm going to have to try and describe these, which frankly is not fair. So Ram, help me out as I go through this one. "Love the pod, makes my time in traffic a great deal better. And your opinions, thoughts, and hilarious rants help me through my workday."
Smiling
face with starry eyes. All right, I'm through the first emoji. "Question for the pod. I'm only a few years into investing and I've really enjoyed opening my mind to a whole new world. But what I, capital D, capital O, capital N-O-T, do not enjoy is looking at the red of the losers in my portfolio. It makes me sad, annoyed, and cranky.
And crazy
face. Is it crazy face? Okay.
I'm going to go crazy face.
Glad you're with the cool kids. All right. My question is, how or when do you stop caring about the losers? I know you can't win them all. I'm competitive, so I love to win. Love it, capital love it. But how do you know when the losers will always be losers and it's time to sell? I know Ram will say it depends on your investment thesis." He's smiling, so that's possible. "But what happens if you are early in your investing journey and just bought certain stocks because they seemed like interesting companies? I'm nearly a year into owning companies like Catapult, Origin Energy, Kogan, Drink." Now, what's
party,
that emoji?
Party face,
all right. "Pushpay and Zipco, and they're all down between 5 and 40%.
Sad cray face.
Tell you what, how good this is, great radio. Is the best path the out of sight, out of mind approach, or just keep them there to remind me it's easy to be wrong? Help. What do you both do? Thanks as always."
Sunglasses emoji.
And then?
And dance emoji.
There we go. That's from Liz. L-A-S. I was Liz.
Yeah, great question.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
What do you do, mate?
So I said earlier, maybe it was in last week's one, that it just sucks. I don't care how experienced,
it just sucks.
Who that's you are, how exactly aware it. Of you, yep. It sucks. I've got Catapult shares. Oh man, they've not gone well lately. I'm not happy about it.
Yep.
What do you do about it? Well, I guess for me, it's always just a refocus and just come back and ask yourself what has changed. Well, obviously the share price has changed. That's the thing that's right in front of you, and that's what's causing all the emotional grief. But what else has changed?
Yeah,
like honestly, I put it out there, Liz. You tell me what's changed. Nothing. They had really incredible result recently. I don't think the business has ever been in better shape. Markets disagrees. So in that case, I don't do a damn thing. Probably be tempted to buy some more, to be honest.
So help me out though, mate. So that's what you do. This is the rational decision. This is the actions you take. Liz's question is, how do you stop caring? So that's a whole different thing, right? So what I should do is, I know that this happened, so I should buy some more, or I should hang on, or I should look at the value of the business. That's kind of in the rational, whichever side of the brain, the rational side of the brain is supposed to be. I can never remember. But how do you stop caring? Like I hear you, but I still hate it.
You can't. I mean, how do you? You can't. You know, it's unavoidable. It's going to feel really crappy. It just is. And I wish I had a hack to say, oh, just do this and you won't feel it anymore. You're always going to feel it. So there's no way around it. But you've just got to remind yourself and just, like eating well. Like, it's just like I really would love to just live on chocolate and ice cream.
A couple of milk, coffee, biscuits, and a Coke Zero in front of me, mate. So I don't appreciate the analogy. Thank you very much.
Well, it's like exercise, right? You go for a walk around the block or a jog or something. It's not as good as sitting on the couch and stuffing your face full of chips. But you know that it's the right thing to do, and you know that it'll have really wonderful long-term benefits if you're consistent on that, Whether or not you can actually follow through on that, that's the hard part. But it's just all I can say is I just continually remind myself of that fact and try my best to ignore the other half, even though I can't ever fully ignore it. So there's no easy. I would love Liz. I would love to sort of say just do this and then don't worry about it. It really sucks. It really, really, really sucks, and it always will. But that's why most people don't do very well at it. Because they can't handle that. I think that is the edge that you can have as a private investor is to have a high degree of emotional fortitude. That is far better than a high IQ when it comes to this. It's so much better. True. The people who get that, they've got a massive edge over the person with 180 IQ that gets just really, flighty every time there's a bit of volatility. So yeah, sorry, I don't. What do you do, Scott? I don't know. Do you have a better answer?
No, I have no better answer. I think the answer is to some degree experience. just having gone through it, you know, knowing that things improve. And this is you can't teach this stuff and you can't give it to somebody. You just have to go through it. But the more you go through it, the more you realize it happens. Mm. The GFC sucked. The COVID crash, honestly, mate, was a relative breeze for me. And my portfolio got smashed because I said travel stocks and retailers. And I got smashed, completely smashed. And I kind of went, oh, that sucks. Now, to be fair, I didn't give my wife a daily update of our portfolio value because that would have been stupid.
I only talk about it when it goes well. That's exactly my life hack.
Yeah. Actually, I don't do either. Actually, generally speaking, I just kind of let it do its thing. So my point was that when you've been through it, the more time you've been investing, the easier it is to deal with it. Not easy. It doesn't make it easy. It makes it easier, which is important. Last question, mate, quickly on Lisa's question, which is, how do you know? So you, as she says or he says, it depends on your investment thesis is going to be your answer. But the market isn't wrong all that often, or at least not by that much, and at least for not that long. And if that's true, then at some point, the question of, I'm really confident, I'm really confident, I'm really confident, I'm really confident, man, I must be missing something, man, I must be missing something, oh, bugger, it's gone broke. Or some version of that where, you know, at some point, you know, there's an arrogance in, well, I'm just going to assume I'm right because I had a good thesis at one point versus actually, you know what, I might just be outright wrong. How do you delineate those decisions of time for me to admit defeat, accept I was wrong, versus I'm going to have the confidence of my convictions and hang on because I still think I'm right. But there's a rational answer, there's a psychological answer in there, there's so much, there's market volatility where frankly the market is wrong a lot for short periods of time, but how do you kind of do all that? Is there an answer to that? How do you do it?
I think for me, what I find really, really, really helpful, and I just use Strawman for that. So just on that, so Strawman's closed in terms of our premium membership, but you can open up a free account and you can use the thing as an investment diary.
Nice.
And it's so, I don't care if you use Strawman, use a Google Doc, I don't care, but write it down. Write down why you're buying this company. The very act of crystallizing those thoughts into writing will clarify your thinking better than anything else. Because you sort of have these ethereal sort of thoughts that all fly, I like that, and they're doing this, and someone I said liked it. And it's just, it all sort of bubbles around and you sort of form a general, you have a certain feeling towards it. Mm. But then you say to someone, okay, well, get out a piece of paper and write down. Write as if you're writing a letter to a good friend and why they should buy the shares. And that's actually really hard. Actually, now I've got to put it into writing, but it will identify for you areas, the holes in your thinking, and it will force you to sort of articulate why you like it. But so that's amazingly valuable, so valuable. But the other value, which is equally as potent, is that it then gives you a really important touchstone when things inevitably change in the future. So when to ask yourself, am I wrong or is the market wrong? Well, you can look back on what you said. Well, I was buying this because I thought that X, Y, and Z. And now I've got something to look at. Now, you know, a few months or years have passed and now I can say, this is why I bought it. Is this still relevant? Some cases it will be. In some cases it won't. If it's not, it's broken. The thesis is broken. Get out. And then maybe you can reformulate it in starting again and you can get back in. But I think that is a process that will help you immeasurably. And I can't stress it enough. And so I'll spruik Strawman. It's all free. So what you can do is you can bring up a company page as a free user. It'll all be private, only you can see it. But you can write what you like about the company in there, create a bunch of what we call them straws, kind of like tweets, you know, bull case, management, risks, whatever you want, right? We'll create a bunch of them. And you can also put in a price that you think is fair. And then you can set a price alert on that as well. So you can log back on and you'll see that, oh, okay, I said that this is why I like the business. I always thought it would be good value around $1.20. Turns out that it's now come below that. Has anything changed? No, it has. No, it hasn't. You know, the thing's given me a notification to say, oh, it's actually hit your price. You know, it just helps hold you to account. And it was very, very deliberately designed that way. So, you know, hopefully it helps. I'll use Catapult as an example, not to speak about stocks and certainly don't run out and do anything with it. Yep. But I bought this company. I've actually done pretty well on it over the years, although, you know, lately it hasn't been that great. But I've got, they are the market leader in the sports analytics industry. They are five times larger than their nearest competitor. Real Madrid, you know, the biggest sporting teams on the planet use them. And their top line has been growing on average for many years now at about 20% per annum. And it's also an industry itself which is growing incredibly rapidly. Like any industry, it's going digital. And so all these athletes are measuring and tracking everything. It's like a Fitbit, but on steroids, right? It's just, it's really, really powerful. And now they've got tactics and coaching solutions that go around that and video analytics, just really powerful. So any elite sporting team around the world, and there's at least 10,000 of these teams around the world when you look at all the various leagues, et cetera, et cetera. And they've been converting their business model to a subscription. From they used to do capital sales, you'd sell it up front. Now they sort of charge a little bit each year, and that the economics of that mean that you actually suffer a little bit in the interim as that sort of plays out. But in terms of the underlying metrics, it's going from strength to strength to strength. You know, it's like, what's changed? Absolutely nothing has changed. But the market didn't like their latest result, and so it sold it off. And I can't work out why. It sucks. I don't like it. I wish it didn't. But at the same time, I've written all of this down in great detail and more, and I can go back to it and I can look and say, what's changed? Nothing's changed. The only thing that's changed is now it's cheaper. So, in fact, by definition, it's a better opportunity than I thought even at the time.
Except that. That's all true as long as your thesis is right in the first place.
Oh, yeah, true.
You still like it. But if you're actually wrong outright, how do you confront the possibility that just the thesis itself is wrong? I mean, as you say, there's one thing. Well, has anything changed? No, I still think. So I'm going to use an example, right? So corporate travel. I owned right through that period of time. We had a recommendation right through that period of time because we thought that Mike was overreacting, the travel would come back, everything will be okay. Turns out that was the case, right? The right thesis. On the other hand, we recommended shares of Retail Food Group, RFG. And we recommended that right through from whatever the price got up to down to about something stupid under a dollar before we eventually sold it. And on the way down was my thought, my belief, that I got completely wrong, at least in terms of the share price subsequently, that this was a business that was unduly impacted by the impact of journalism. I would say activist journalism, but you can draw your own conclusions. That the fundamental the underlying business was actually still sound. There's nothing had changed in terms of the number of coffees people were going to buy or what that looked like. But the number of franchisees that were signing up was impacted by the fact that, frankly, no one was touching it with a barge pole because all this bad news was around. And so my conviction was it is worth more than the market's assuming once things normalize and come back. Now, that was just so far at least and probably forever absolutely wrong. But I held to my conviction because that was my belief and that was my belief and that was my belief. Nothing had changed about that view except that I was just outright wrong and outright wrong for a long period of time while the shares cratered. And frankly, we were still some unhappy members about that and fair enough too. So there's that, right? There's one, has anything changed? No. Was I wrong? Yeah, seems like it. I'm not prepared to call any thesis closed until the time eventually plays out. Maybe corporate travel goes to zero. Maybe RFG goes to $10. Who knows? But in the interim, it looks like I was right about corporate travel. It looks like I was wrong about RFG. I held a conviction in both those positions for those reasons. It wasn't that the circumstances had changed, it was I got it wrong. How do you deal with that? Because that's the listener's question. It's fine to say I still believe it. I'm still going to keep on. One or more of the companies might be low. Those companies might be just dogs. They might be bad ideas, and maybe recognizing that error is part of the process. How do you do that? How do you work out when your thesis is wrong?
Well, it's also a question of just losing conviction in it as well. So to take RFG, you felt as though look, there's a bit of bad press out there that's causing people to sign up, but it will normalize.
Yes,
that's a reasonable standpoint to take. But then you know a bit of time passed, and then a bit more time passed, and it just didn't. So at a point, you know, you could have made the argument that it's just sort of like it wasn't an unreasonable thing to think, but it turns out that it actually was a lasting thing, and these things tend to feed on themselves as well. Yep. And so even though you might have still thought that, I probably, you know, your conviction in that waned as well. And you sort of hit a point where it's just like, well, I still kind of think that might be the case, but am I as confident as I was before? And there's nothing wrong with that. So it's not as though you will never know. It's your point. Maybe corporate travel goes to zero. Maybe RFG goes up 100-fold from here. You don't ever know, but your conviction in that can change. And when you get to a point where it's just you don't have a high conviction, I think for me, that's the point that you get out. It's not easy, is it? It's really not easy.
Can I suggest an alternative, mate? And this is, again, one you might completely disagree with, which would be great if you do. You've heard me say this before, but be slow to buy and even slower to sell is my general thought around this sort of stuff. And David Gardner, the Motley Fool co-founder and chief rule breaker, talks about, you know, by the time his losers have lost, they're so small they're almost inconsequential anyway. And so there's an argument, and I don't necessarily – I think this is probably – if I look at ShareAdvisor, our service is now, as I said, 10 years old last week. and I looked at the long-term history of that, I probably would have been better never to have sold, including the losers like RFG, because others that I've sold and have gone to do even better, I missed the upside. Mm. And I'm almost going to say that depending on your portfolio and your diversification, your goals, all that kind of stuff, there's a straight argument to say, hey, if you've been wrong enough for long enough and the shares are worth that little, possibly not a great amount of time spent thinking about whether to sell or not, better off looking for new opportunities and moving from there. And maybe it might be better in your own portfolio to say, hey, just don't sell. Why sell? Just move on. Collect the assets. If it's a 58% position and you've decided the whole thing's broken, that's a different question. But in the uncertainty, I'm not sure it would be better just to hang on rather than try and work out when the best price, time, whatever is to sell, and devote that time to finding the next big winner rather than worrying about whether or not RFG is going to fall from 28 cents to 10 cents. Well, in the meantime, you could be finding something that's going to go from $1 to $5. Any value in that?
No, I have a lot of sympathy for that view. The one sort of consideration there, though, is in a newsletter service, you have infinite capital.
Yeah.
So in the sense that each month you get to make a new recommendation, and you're measured on that as if it was sort of like, you know, the same amount sort of put in.
Yeah.
In the real world, some people, like, now if you're employed and you're saving a regular amount, that's probably a fair comparison. But there'll be a lot of people who don't. Who only have what they have in the market. And so for them, it's kind of like, well, then for them to buy something, they have to sell something to free up capital to buy the next thing. So there's a practical element to that. So I think if you're in a situation where you've got fresh capital coming in all the time, I've actually got a lot of sympathy for that approach. If you're not, and a lot of people aren't, or even if it's a question of, well, you are, but, you know, I'll just give a stupid number. Let's say you've got a $10 million portfolio, but you're saving $100 a week. You know, that's really whatever, even though you get fresh capital to come along every week to sort of invest, it's just like it's never going to move the dial overall. So depending on how all of that kind of settles out, I think that for a lot of people, if it's always the one of the big ideas in investing that people have to get their head around is this idea of opportunity cost. And so while that's true, it's a very small position, doesn't really matter, and the other ones are doing the heavy lifting and making up for it. Yeah. But, you know, maybe you had $10,000 this thing and now it's worth $2,000 in it. But that $2,000 can be put in. There's no tax on it because you've made a loss. In fact, there's a tax benefit. So for the sake of, you know, $10 brokerage or whatever, you can pick it up and put it somewhere else. And whenever you're not doing that, you're suffering an opportunity cost drag on that capital. So I think in those circumstances, you are best to sort of say, I got it wrong. It's gonna, like we said at the start, 40% of the time, I'm at best, you know, if I'm lucky, I'm going to get it wrong. And this is one of those instances. And I'm wrong not because the share price went down. I'm wrong because the thesis was busted and my thinking and my rationale and everything behind it. My expectations for the business turned out to be wrong. Get the hell out. Move on. Put it into something else. Add to something else that's doing a lot better. Business is doing a lot better. Does that make sense?
It does indeed. Mate, Lucas had a similar question. We're not going to answer it separately unless we add some thoughts. But basically he just said, look, I've got some shares. They've dropped about 30%. He said, look, do you have any updated views? Do you have any more convictions for a couple of stocks that we've recommended in some of our services? He said, is this a good time to dollar cost average down for newer members who may have bought higher, or could this be a new down level, re-rating, due to all the inflation talk going on? Do we buy the dip and keep adding? I know we should be looking 3 years ahead, but thought it may be a good time to talk about it before the holidays, or during the holidays, as it turns out, all for the mental side of investing. Cheers and full on, Lucas. I think it's the same thing, right? It's the business versus the share price. And I think in that case, if there's a difference, there's a difference.
I mean, the best mental exercise here is we've said before, is just imagine you've get rid of the mental baggage and the history of it. Yep. You know, so all of this stuff has happened and you just can't change the past. But what you can do is act for the future. And so you just imagine you inherited your portfolio, right, from someone else. And that's where it sits. Doesn't really matter what the profit or loss is. You hold X dollars in company A, Y dollars in company B, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Are you happy with that? Then no need to act. If there are changes that you feel need to be made, then make it. Just look forward. Don't look backwards. Backwards is really important for record keeping, for tax, for performance measurement. It's all of that kind of stuff.
Yep.
In terms of it, but it just does not impact your future returns. It can't. All you can do is impact the future. So
it's not going to tell you whether a business is worth owning at the current price either.
No. It might have been really expensive before, dropped 30%, and it's still really expensive.
Yes,
you
know, exactly.
Maybe if you blinked into existence today, you'd look at it and go, I don't care. You could drop down another 80%. I still wouldn't touch it with a barge hole. Or maybe you thought it was great value and now it's 30%. It's even better value. But you won't be able to answer that question until you've formed some independent view of where the true value actually lies. I know that's a hard question. It's a big question, one that requires a lot of work, but it's the only kind of question that you can ask that makes any logical sense. I mean, otherwise, what framework, what context is there for this price? It's just, it's higher or lower depending on where it was, not higher or lower depending on where it intrinsically is. You know what
I got a question. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. No, it absolutely does. Absolutely does. My question from Alex, who has a really interesting question. I haven't had this one before. Hi, Scott and Andrew. I have a question that's a bit open-ended and possibly a bit niche, but I thought it could lend itself to a discussion within your upcoming pre-recorded summer series. Here we are, which I understand is a bit more pre-recorded than the usual podcast. It is, Alex. Thank you. What are your thoughts, impressions, or objections to rules-based or regular rebalancing strategies, such as Joel Greenblatt's magic formula and Tobias Carlyle's acquirer's multiple? I find these investing approaches interesting and conceptually sound, at least to a point, and I might even be tempted to buy one of the US-listed ETFs based on these strategies one day. Personally, while I might incorporate these strategies as part of a screening process, I still find the approach of buy, hold, quality, value investors like Buffett and Lynch more appealing. Would be interested to hear your thoughts, Alex. Now, just quickly, the magic formula approach, I don't know much about the acquirer's multiple actually, but magic formula approach basically says, hey, you rebalance your portfolio, you go and find the highest performing companies at the cheapest prices and you buy those, and then next time around you sell them all and just buy back the next lot of cheapest and best. In theory, if you're always buying the best at the cheapest prices, a bit like Andrew said, if you take your portfolio out of cash every so often, every year I suppose it is, and then buy back just the best ones, in theory, that's a market-beating potential. Alex saying, hey, I find it attractive because it kind of makes conceptual sense, but I kind of find myself still a bit of a Lynch Buffett investor. Would be interested to hear your thoughts. What do you recommend? Do you kind of go for the rebalancing formulaic approach, or do you go for the kind of, you know, buy stuff, sit in it for a very long time and get rich?
Well, the interesting thing about these approaches is that they appear because when you backtest, they work really well. Mm-hmm. But there's always danger in backtesting because the future is often different to the past.
Yeah.
It's also true to say that even for the ones that seem to have worked pretty well, that they still, like any approach, suffer long periods of underperformance and the rest of it. Mm-hmm. And within that, they only kind of work when you do it on a large enough scale. So it's not as though you can have a portfolio of 10 stocks using Joel Greenblatt's magic formula kind of thing, because it works at scale, or at least in the past, it's because he's bought like, you know, 1,000 stocks and you know, 450 of them completely didn't work out. So it's kind of one of the, if you're going to follow it, you kind of have to really sort of follow it. And that there's sort of like practical difficulties with doing that as a private investor. So I think I don't tend to. Where I've evolved as an investor is I've found that the qualitative things just tend to be the most important things. Mm. So all of these rules based kind of things all depend on things that you can measure. So in Joel Greenblatt's, I think it's return on equity and the earnings yield or something like those two metrics. Right.
Yep.
But doesn't tell you anything about management, doesn't tell you anything about company strategy, tells you nothing about the competitive position. You know, all of these things that just don't, you can't have a metric for and you can't put into a spreadsheet and you can't scan against. Mm. And I find that as I've gone on, it's just sort of, not that I don't look at those kinds of things. I think that they do tell a story and they are revealing in some way, but it's more how they all sort of fit together in aggregate and how you can perhaps explain them through the qualitative fuzzy kinds of things that you can't do it. So, but each to their own. So, but I'm with you, Alex. I think the Lynch Buffett kind of style more appealing. And even within that, there's plenty of things that those guys have done that I don't do. You've really got to find your own way is the bottom line. What resonates for you? What makes sense? What's kind of got a bit of evidence sort of behind it? What gels with your temperament and your skill set? And you just you'll find that it changes. And I'm a very different investor today than I was even 5 years ago. And yeah, I'm pretty sure that when I look back in the year 2027, I'll look at myself today and go, oh, how cute, you know. I used to think this, you know, and it just changes. It should change. So yeah, it's a journey. That's a really unsatisfying answer. I wish I could be more specific.
No, it's a really good one. I find myself in a similar place to you, mate. And a pretty good reason. I think this is, it is kind of temperament, right? Like I could imagine in a different universe, I'm a massive Magic Formula fan. Because I particularly as a young, and to your point of changing as an investor, as a young investor, I've said many times, I knew 60 ratios, right? And I calculated them all, and I put them in Excel, and I knew, you know, the price of everything and the value of nothing. That was absolutely where I was. I could imagine that turning into a, hey, this Magic Formula thing seems to work. If I replicate this strategy, I can beat the market. Why wouldn't you try and just own the best stuff you can find? I think I would speculate that a Magic Formula ETF would do better than an average ETF. And I think if I was going to buy an ETF, I could absolutely imagine myself buying into a Magic Formula style ETF. I could absolutely imagine doing that. It's also, though, true to your point, mate, about backtesting, that things like, for example, value investing was all the rage for decades. Mm. And the last decade has done really badly relative to growth. Not really badly overall, I don't think, but really badly relative to growth. Does that mean value investing is dead because it doesn't backtest anymore? Or does that mean the future, when mean reverts, is a big opportunity? Conversely, is growth the new thing? Or is growth the bubble that's waiting to pop because it's so dramatically outperformed value for good reasons, bad reasons, question mark, don't know. I don't have a view, but you know what I mean? It's hard to really rely on that stuff. Like, you know, when stuff changes, it changes. Ben Graham used to invest, funnily enough, you talk about screens, Warren Buffett's mentor, Ben Graham, actually invested doing a Magic Formula style thing, but with book value. And he invested in literally hundreds and I think even thousands of companies over his lifetime. So he was saying this really massive scale screening opportunity, buying everything that fit these criteria. That's been competed away. That doesn't exist anymore. And so when those things stop working, they stop working. The same is true of individual investing, by the way, because prices, values, investor expectations change. Frankly, I think growth only works because investors currently or historically in the last, but recently historically, have been undervaluing the future growth. There's no reason that tech stocks should do well, right? Or what it says, if today's value was right, if the market's got tech right now, it means it was undervalued then.
Yeah.
It's not because they don't do well because they're tech. They do well because we undervalued tech then or overvalue it now or both. Not because tech has anything magical about it. If you said, hey, Amazon should be worth $1,000 at IPO rather than $9 at IPO, if the market had realized or recognized, then Amazon would have been an average stock over the last 25 years. You know, and we have a very different conversation about exactly the same company. So price matters. Bottom line, I have no issue with it. I think from what I understand, Greenblatt's approach is fundamentally sound and I wouldn't criticize anyone for doing it. You do tend to miss out on the compound gains and you want to be a little bit careful you don't kind of, you know, you don't miss those. I imagine if you'd bought and sold Amazon based on the Magic Formula, would you have done better than holding Amazon for the whole time? Maybe. Or maybe the year you didn't own it, if it came back in between those periods of time, you sold it on December 31, by the next December 31, it had gone up, you know, 400%, and then you bought it back. If you miss too many years of those gains, you probably struggle. So
yeah.
I think I would. Again, I wouldn't criticize anyone for doing it. It's not my style either. Maybe it's the best way to put it.
Yeah.
Mate, I reckon we're pretty done for the first. That's not bad for the first podcast of the new year. Started with a bang.
Yeah.
Pretty happy about that. Hopefully you've enjoyed our answers to your questions. We appreciate you sending them through.
Some really good questions.
Always. Yeah, they were
really
some great
good,
questions.
Hard questions.
And the good news, mate, will you make 2022 even better than 2021 and come back again for me?
I will try. I will absolutely try. Well, I will try to make it better. I mean, I will be back, but I will try to make it better.
Clear as mud. That was Andrew Page. I'm Scott Phillips. Thank you for spending a little bit of your time with us. If you want to follow Andrew, do so on Sage_Simeon or Strawman Invest on Twitter. You can get me at TMF Scott P on Twitter and Insta and Scott Phillips Money on Facebook. Until next Friday, full on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services Licence 400691. Listener.